Chapter 2. When the Light is Feeble. There may be many people who would express their readiness to apply themselves to the study of Christian principles if they could feel assured of the truth of Christian claims. They have grave doubts, however, as to whether there is a God who cares for humanity, or whether he has given any commands to men. We are, of course, writing primarily for readers who have long since satisfied themselves as to these fundamental matters, and we are confident that the way is open for others to find a similar resolution to their discordant doubtings, if only they will take the trouble to study along the right lines. Howbeit, in case any who do not recognize the authority of the Bible should chance to read these lines, we suggest that, although they start at the wrong end of the subject, they may be able to find some helpful light by the examination of certain palpable facts and natural laws that may appropriately be examined here. There are some practices of humanity that are harmful and destructive, even to animal health. Is not this suggestive of divine law? Man is often disgusted with himself. Why should this be if man is himself the author of all his ideals? Are not human needs and cravings all necessarily related to external realities? Could we conceive of any creatures hungering for food and drink if no food or drink suitable for them had ever existed? Or the need for fresh air if there had never been any air upon earth better than that found in a closed-up railway compartment full of smokers? Or the need for a mate, if no mate had ever been either in objective reality or in the purpose of God? From whence, then, comes this craving of our spiritual faculties, with some people the strongest craving of all? It is useless to ignore it, and equally futile to point out that some men never feel it. In a condition of extreme ill health, men do not desire food. Often it seems that they do not desire fresh air. Some men have lost all interest in women. The argument remains untouched that these primitive needs are felt by healthy men, and the needs are clearly related to the external facts. We can hardly conceive of any thinker challenging this general proposition that the primitive human needs imply the existence somewhere of that which would satisfy them. At least the proposition would be admitted so long as there was no objectionable conclusion in sight. Even the thoroughgoing disciple of Haeckel, if any such materialist still survives, would admit the main proposition. He would say, "Of course a man's need for food and drink is related to the existence of food and drink suitable for him, and his need of a woman is related to the existence of a woman. He evolved in this manner. His parents from the beginning of life were sustained by food and drink and air such as earth provides. It was through the need of companionship and the instincts of sex that he was called into being. They breathed the atmosphere that surrounds the earth, and so lungs were developed suitable for such breathing of air. It is perfectly natural and obvious that all our primitive needs should be related to the facts in the embrace of which we have evolved." All of which reasoning only emphasizes the significance of the fact that we need God, that we yearn for communion with something higher and nobler than ourselves, that we have ideals that make our attainments seem contemptible and sometimes even disgusting. How strange it would be if creatures that evolved themselves out of shapeless slime should, along with a need for the food that had nourished them, develop a spiritual hunger for something that never existed and never could exist. How strange if they should, of their own bestial instincts, evolve ideals that make them miserable, because the animal desires continually prevent attainment. It is surprising that the human consciousness of sin, one of the greatest facts in all the world, should be completely ignored by men who claim to be logical. It is clear that men who deny the existence of a creator cannot believe in the existence of sin. If man is only the product of a billion chances, he is clearly at liberty to make his own laws, and no considerations of conscience need trouble him. He can proudly say, "Who is Lord over me? In all the universe, I own no superior. That which I do is always right, even if it is not always wise." Truly, in such a situation, the place of wisdom would be found. It would be in the depths. Perhaps men who have accepted this extreme of materialism have never experienced any craving for communion with God. Perhaps they are also devoid of any consciousness of sin, or they have reasoned themselves out of it. They find no response in their hearts to such words as those found in Psalm 42, and cannot understand why other men are moved by them. Our argument is not affected, however, by the fact that in some human beings, all the higher powers are atrophied. We are on the animal plane, and it is possible to live on that plane, even when all the distinguishing characteristics of humanity have gone. It is possible to live for a little while, even after the animal appetite has gone. The fact remains that some souls do long for communion with God, as the heart pants for the springs of water. From whence comes this longing? How has it evolved? It has been suggested that human consciousness of sin is not entirely without parallel in the animal world. Some of the higher mammals, especially dogs, sometimes reveal signs of guilty conscience. There is evidence of uneasiness and something very closely akin to human shame, even when there is no reason to fear the pain of actual punishment. We agree that we have seen a dog show signs of shame and contrition in a manner touchingly human. This, however, only confirms our argument. He was not a wild dog. He had not evolved his own doggy ideals to bring him self-reproach through a failure to attain. Anyone who saw him would instantly recognize the human influence. The dog had been given a law by one whom he recognized as incontestably his superior and his master, and he had broken that law. Who is the unmistakable master who has given a law to man? These thoughts may suggest the desirability of further investigation, even to those who have been most skeptical towards all claims of religion. They may suggest, at least, that it is unwise to keep the door of the mind bolted and barred against the idea that God has ever given a message to man. In the absence of such bolts and bars, there is always hope of grace. We may reason a little further on the basis of some of the palpable facts of ordinary life. A truth that shines out very clearly is that mere negatives will lead to nothing of value. The man who shirks all responsibility for constructive work and uses his talents merely to deride and destroy the work of others is a curse to those among whom he moves. To criticize is so much the easier task that many choose it rather than attempt to render service. We grow impatient with such men at last and seek the society of those who, with less pretense of ability, really attempt to accomplish something. In the same way, we should soon grow tired of the young man whose whole attitude toward his future work was expressed in doubts and antipathies. It is futile for him to be clear in his mind only as to the careers that he would detest. We should say, "It is time for you to find what you would like to be, not merely what you would dislike. When you have found the most suitable opening, it is futile for you to hesitate merely because you are not sure whether you will like it or prove a success in it. We cannot be absolutely sure of any such matter. We must be directed by reason to the most promising avenue and then get forward with positive and constructive work." In all the ordinary experiences of humanity, this principle will be recognized as wise. Life itself is an affirmation, and when we can no longer affirm, we are on the way to death. Surely then, we must not be content with negatives in connection with the most important issue of all. Every negative implies its positive. We are always in a position to affirm just as definitely as we are able to deny. But there is such a difference in the matter of where we put the emphasis. If a man is quite sure that there is no God, then he is equally sure that everything came into existence without a creator. He must be prepared to affirm that a blind, unconscious, unreasoning force has produced seeing, conscious, reasoning beings. Through thus facing the implied positives, he may find that while the difficulties of believing in God are great, the difficulties of unbelief are still greater. It may be well, sometimes, to assume that mental attitude described as sitting on the fence, but with important issues, it must not be sustained for long. Life is too short to admit of such delay, and it is rare for the needed illumination to come to us unbidden. The man who sits on the fence, calling out discouraging criticisms to every passerby, and unwilling to accept information from anyone as to right direction for home, will probably be avoided after a little while. He will remain sitting on the fence until he tumbles off with the passing of life. We can remember once cycling in a desolate part of the country and being overtaken by nightfall while still many miles from home. We knew that there was a country station not very far away, and there was a train due to leave it in 10 minutes' time. We were approaching a road at right angles. The station was somewhere the other side of the road, but we did not know whether the lane leading to it was to our right or our left. When we reached the main road, there was no finger post and no sign of humanity. There was certainly no time for delay. It was better to take the wrong turning, with a chance of quickly finding out our mistake, than to wait at the corner with no prospect of any information coming to us, and the certainty that in a very few minutes it would be too late. It was clearly a time to act on the basis of such slender evidence as we could see. There was no sign of hope to the left of us, but on the right hand there was a feeble glimmer of light reflected in the sky, and it might possibly be from the station. Without pausing for a moment, we hastened to the right hand, and presently received successive and increasingly powerful confirmations that our choice was justified. The feeble light grew stronger. There was a lane leading directly to it. We caught a glimpse of a red light, and finally there were the clearly defined lights of the station and the distant sound of the approaching train. There is a certain allegorical significance in such an experience. The mere negation is immobile and will soon be dead. The affirmation moves, and soon may find either evidence that it is wrong, and its movement must be changed, or confirmation that it is right, and the pace may be increased. It is a matter of vital importance for Christians and rejectors alike to find the right course without any avoidable delay. Progress is better than stagnation, even though at first the guiding light seems feeble. There are many who have 10 minutes of hard riding before they can reach their goal, and they only have 11 more minutes of life.